Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
My new book, Diary of a Psychosis, is out. It's the most lively, devastating baseball bat to the throat takedown of what the public health establishment did in 2020 and beyond that you can imagine. It's my first book in 9 years, and you're going to love it. Check it out at diaryofcovid.com. And if you've already bought it, make sure also to visit diaryofcovid.com so you can claim your free bonuses, including my free companion volume, Collateral Damage, a collection of stories from real people who suffered under the restrictions. They weren't allowed to tell their stories at the time, but every one of them told me, "We just want to be heard." Check it all out at diaryofcovid.com. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to The Tom Woods Show. This is, believe it or not, episode 2441, but the first one ever with Professor Amy Wax, who is a professor at the Law School of the University of Pennsylvania, who is a lightning rod, who is controversial, and that's my kind of guest. She has a great deal to say on a great many topics, many but not all of them pertaining to the law, and boy, do I have plenty of questions for her. So, Amy, if I may, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here, Tom.
Let's start with a recent item that I don't know if you've commented on, namely the resignation of Claudine Gay. And I wonder if you think that the circumstances surrounding her resignation are so unique that we shouldn't draw any conclusions from it, that maybe there's a crack forming in the DEI apparatus. Or do you, in fact, find some cause for hope or optimism in what happened?
Well, I think the Claudine Gay resignation, the circumstances obviously are different from, let's say, the resignation of our Penn former president, Liz McGill, which is a separate matter. So I'll just address Claudine Gay. I think that the circumstances are really not all that unique. Claudine Gay's main infraction was to plagiarize repeatedly in her scholarly work and in her dissertation, and that plagiarism is a violation of core academic values. The way I put it to people is plagiarism is about dishonoring honesty, intellectual honesty. Intellectual honesty is a key component upon which Western achievements, Western accomplishments, Western ways and society are built. Without that kind of rigor, the empiricism, the honesty and fair dealing in our intellectual endeavors, technological and otherwise, we could not have built the glorious society that we have and exported it all around the world. Now, the problem, of course, here is a deep one, which is there are forces in our society, especially on the left, that are attacking these very core values of the West, of post-Enlightenment West, including intellectual integrity, rigor, consistency, honesty, achievement, competence. That whole list is associated with whiteness. And for Gay to just carelessly flout the value of intellectual honesty, that is a direct challenge to our legacy. Now, I think with Gay, what came together, what was revealed, is our continuing deep ambivalence about the core components of whiteness. On the one hand, we have allowed individuals and minorities to launch a full frontal attack on those core values, and a lot of white people have, in my mind, inexplicably gone along with it. On the other hand, there are doubts about that, you know, we can't give up these values, that these are important and core components of our institutions and of our success. And I think the Gay situation really brought that ambivalence to the fore. We need to make up our mind about whether we're going to have a meritocratic, fact-based society that incorporates and brings forward these values, or whether we're going to trash these values. And I think Gay's appointment really highlights a lot of the problems of ignoring these values, right? One of the core values, of course, is the meritocracy, that everybody's judged by the same standard. Well, Gay, in being appointed Harvard president, she was not judged by the same standard. She has 11 publications. A number of them have been attacked and discredited. They're really kind of mediocre or worse. She wouldn't even get her foot in the door for a Harvard appointment if she were not Black. So she, you know, was promoted and she is in the position she's in because of her race. I think that's a fair statement. Now, people will say, oh, that's racist. They'll throw all these labels at you. I ignore that stuff because that's just the rhetoric and the tools and the weapons of the left. And we really have to get over that stuff, get over being afraid of it. So it is quirky in that at the end of the day, it was her plagiarism that brought her down rather than her performance before Congress, which, by the way, had many flaws, and we can get into that. But I think the plagiarism issue is a microcosm of the values clash that is going on in our society right now.
Now, there's no doubt that there are obviously white liberals behind so much of DEI and all the things that you and I deplore. But at the same time,
I really wouldn't call them liberals because they're not liberal.
I know. I mean, we can come up with some other term.
We could argue about terms, but you take my point.
Yeah, I do indeed. I accept that friendly amendment. But it's still obvious from seeing some of the demonstrations and stuff that there are people, and I guess my thought is, and I guess maybe this is not allowed to say this, but I don't understand why. What kind of person would you have to be, and how would you have to have been raised to enter somebody else's society and say, you all need to revolutionize your legal system to accommodate me. You need to give preference to my children over your own children. You need to tear down statues I dislike, and you need to engage in a national breastfeeding that persists in perpetuity. I mean, what kind of person, could you imagine moving to someone else's society and acting like that?
Well, I'm sorry to report, and this, I think, just highlights the huge polarized divide in our society today. I cannot imagine thinking that way. I cannot imagine it. I just puzzle over it. What forces in our society and in our childbearing practices, our education system, are leading to this set of attitudes? I mean, one thing that's going on is the whole idea of gratitude, of being grateful for what people before you have built and bequeathed to you, is so unfashionable. That's associated with that reverence, that piety, as Edmund Burke would call it, is associated with being lower class. We have now all of these sort of class markers in attitudes. Where they come from, I'm not entirely sure. I guess they come from, you know, the lefty playbook. If you are upper middle class, to say that you are grateful for Western civ, well, you just don't say that, right? I mean, I say it all the time. And the evidence for it that we ought to be is just all around us. I mean, these people use their iPhones. They go running to the best doctors when there's something wrong with them. They take advantage of all of the achievements and advances of our society and our civilization, European civilization. Yes, European civilization, I will call it that. And yet they think that it somehow falls from the sky. And this has to come from an upbringing that is so insular and so coddling and really so bizarre that it's very hard for me to understand it. It's certainly nothing like the upbringing that I had. So maybe I would locate some of it in child rearing, but also our education system, K through 12, is really a huge culprit here, and it doesn't get nearly enough emphasis. I think the takeover of the ed schools with these bizarre anti-Western self-hating attitudes is complete. These schools are churning out the teachers that man are and woman are K through 12 establishment. These people subtly interweave in their teaching these attitudes that the United States is an inherently oppressive and racist society, but that's the most important thing about us. And the curriculum reflects it. I mean, it's all about racism. It's all about the experience of minorities. There's very little about the great men, the founders, their ideas, even the nuts and bolts and the mechanics of how our system works, which people get out of school knowing nothing about. So I think the K through 12 system is a huge culprit. And when you take a 5 or 6 year old and you peddle this stuff to them and they hear no opposing views, except maybe at home, and even at home, who knows what they're hearing, then what can you expect? There is no balance in what is presented in these schools, even on racial issues. They don't bring in, they don't read Thomas Sowell. They don't read the sort of culturalists or the people who oppose the current Ibram Kendi progressive catechism. They don't even know who these people are, right? And the facts about our country, both good and bad, are not presented in an even-handed way. So I still don't understand what's going on. I'll add a third component here, and then I'll shut up, which is racial guilt. Just this tremendous guilt about what we have done to Blacks and minorities in the past. And I readily concede that we have done some awful things, but we've just made tremendous progress since then. And frankly, racial guilt is something I don't feel. I feel regretful and sad about the past, our past, and some of the things we've done, but I don't feel personally responsible for it. I have lived in an era where we have done wonders in dispelling a lot of these problems and insults. And frankly, I do not feel responsible for the fate of Black America. Black America needs to feel responsible for its own fate under current conditions, because so many of their problems come from their own choices and behaviors. Their self-sabotage at this point is virtually complete. And that is an attitude that is just not permitted. It's verboten. It's been banished from the centers of correct opinion, the opinion-shaping institutions. And we need to bring it back as an important voice to balance what young people are taught and what they hear. We need to do that. That is, to me, a top priority. That is, by the way, why I am still a DeSantis supporter, because I think that he is the only candidate that really takes this problem of indoctrination of young people, and that is exactly what is occurring, okay, whether you like it or not, seriously. It's really important. Really important issue.
I'm 51 years old and I've observed a lot in those 51 years. And it is obvious that if you are Black and competent in the United States, the world is your oyster. You're going to zoom to the front.
It's open to you in every possible way. Now, of course, you're a human being. There are going to be setbacks and disappointments in the ordinary course. But if the meritocracy is working properly, and it's always imperfect, but we've had a good run of it, then you will make your way. You will establish a decent life. That is, if your behavior is otherwise conducive to that. I mean, you know, there are other problems that Blacks, even Blacks who are competent and capable, have that they need to address. Their weak families, the high rate of crime in the Black community, educational underachievement in general, all of that. But if you are a good, upstanding citizen and work hard and do well and learn something in school as a Black person, yes, the world is your oyster. And in implying or saying otherwise, the leadership is lying, that there are falsehoods here being peddled. And I think, to me, that is one of the biggest problems in our current age in the United States, current situation, is the number of falsehoods and lies that are being circulated is just tremendous. I mean, it's astonishing. And anybody who tries to correct those falsehoods can easily get into trouble. I'm sort of a case in point here. I'm sure you've gotten a huge amount of pushback, too. Centers of power and thought, like the universities, they tolerate pretty much no dissent at this point.
I will say that the word racism seems to have lost quite a bit of its sting over the past 10 years or so, because, you know, all people I would actually take seriously, they see that name, if somebody called that name, and they know what that means. The person has just said five sensible things and that's it. Nobody, again, I would take seriously, hears that word and thinks, this is probably a person of bad will who wants to hurt people. I don't know. I assume that it's because you said affirmative action is bad or whatever. But also it is used, as you know, as a substitute for argument. So it's like if I ask students, if I drop this pen, if I let go of this pen, what happens? And they'll say, well, it'll hit the ground. And I'll say, well, why is that? And they'll say, gravity. And I'll say, can you elaborate on that? And they'll say, no. So what they've done is they've taken a word, they've assigned a word to the phenomenon, but this helps me in my understanding in no way. Well, likewise, for me to make an argument and for me to say, I actually don't think blacks are underrepresented in various occupations. I really don't. I don't think they're being treated unfairly. And I can demonstrate that. And they'll say, that's racist. Okay, you've used a word. Now you got that out of your system. Can you evaluate the truth or falsity of what I've said?
Well, the word, I mean, I'm going to partly agree with you and partly disagree with you. I think there is a growing segment of people on the right in various, along that various spectrum, who have been called racist so many times that it really has lost its sting somewhat. And of course, the word is a weapon. It's never defined or specified. It can mean whatever people want it to mean. It's a form of bullying without question. But within our main institutions, like the mainstream media, the universities, Hollywood, really a lot of the corporate world, frankly, business, to accuse someone of racism is still a fearsome thing. It still has consequences. And the people within those entities, and that's a vast number of people, right? They are really, really gun shy about being called racist. They are terrified of being called racist. Take university medical centers. I have a number of relatives who are medical school professors. And wow, I mean, if there is a segment of society that is a complete monolith, an orthodox echo chamber of uniform ideas about race that everyone must conform to, it is medical schools and the medical academy. And anyone who dares to speak up is immediately penalized and scrubbed. So you have a small contingent. It's hard to know how big it is because everybody's so afraid to speak their mind, who are radically opposed to the whole DEI double standard affirmative action machine that is now operating in these competitive medical schools. They are irradically opposed to it for all sorts of good reasons, but they don't say anything. I mean, because why? Because they don't want to be accused of racism. I was just hearing last night about a surgeon, I think he's down in Florida. He's not in the academy. He's just a private practice. I think his name is Bossart, who a while ago wrote a piece saying that academic medicine and medicine in general is headed in the wrong direction, that they're ceasing to be the meritocracy that has generated so many of its achievements and its contributions. And we really ought to go back to a single standard for everyone, even if it means that there will be relatively few blacks in medicine and almost none in academic medicine, because here we're talking about super competitive environment. And he was ejected from the American Academy of Surgeons, which is a private organization, but gets to set its own rules. He was accused of racism, of harboring attitudes that were contrary to the fundamental values and principles of that organization, not even an academic organization, just a group of surgeons forming a club effectively, and is persona non grata now. One other example, Stanley Goldfarb, a person who had been deeply involved in PenMed and administering PenMed, heading up all sorts of programs, a renal specialist, and he's now in his late 70s, but he retired and started an organization called Do No Harm, which is opposed once again to DEI in medical schools, to affirmative action, to all of the sort of race conscious disparities research that is crowding out real research in the academy and is sort of a jobs program for minorities. He's written against all of that. And PenMed effectively turned him into a pariah. They've sent out circulars saying, don't talk to Stanley Goldfarb. He's an enemy of the people. He's persona non grata at PenMed, I'll tell you that. And he's been accused of everything in the book. So that is the fate that awaits people who dare to deviate in the slightest. And these are people who are highly educated, highly capable, but their job status is actually remarkably tenuous. Most professors in med schools, top med schools, don't have tenure. Their appointments depend on getting grants, on being supported from within the academy. They serve at the mercy of their department chairs. The whole way that academic medicine is organized puts people in a precarious position. It really puts people in a position where they fear for their jobs if they curry disfavor within the academy. And that is a formula for conformity, right? It is absolutely, if you were to devise a better system for tyranny over the mind, for suppressing dissent, you couldn't design it. You can see it in COVID too, in the way they treat COVID. Okay. PenMed, for its cancer center anyway, has brought back masking. You can imagine that. And I have never seen a presentation at PenMed where people sat down and aired the pros and the cons of masking, the case for it, the scientific case, the data. They don't do that. This is the orthodoxy. You can't question it. Well, that's not a way for science to work. That's crazy. But that is what they're doing.
I hate to sound naive by pointing out a contradiction in what they say, as if they have any problem living with a contradiction, but for those of us who do believe in intellectual consistency, I will note as an exercise that on the one hand, it seems that they're perfectly at peace saying that whites as a group exhibit certain negative group characteristics. They have no problem saying that. You will hear a lot of them say all white people are racist and they're either conscious of it or they're unconscious of it, but they all have this negative quality. And the more they protest that they don't see race, the worse they are. And they're fiendishly clever because they use seemingly neutral ideas like meritocracy to extend their domination of society. All these sorts of things, there are things that are said about white people as a group collectively about how negative and undesirable they are. But apparently no other group, any other group has only positive characteristics. So obviously they have no problem with making sweeping statements about people. It just depends on which people you're talking about. Then secondly, the logic of DEI, and when we use this acronym, we mean diversity, equity, and inclusion. The logic of these programs is that if there are racial disparities in outcomes, whatever institution is generating those outcomes, it's that institution's fault. There's somebody to blame. This is a moral failing. And so the institution has to constantly reform itself, constantly throw out standards, because it never reaches the desired goal. Even all these progressive school districts that have tried absolutely everything to get rid of the roughly 4-grade achievement gap between blacks and whites, no matter what they've tried, they haven't been able to get rid of it. So this makes them beat their breast even further that the racism must go deeper than they thought. I don't know how you stay sane. This is an insane asylum.
It is insane. I mean, you are right to identify the fundamental axioms of wokeness, right? Well, a fundamental axiom where it all begins is that any deviation from parity in the representation of various groups, and that includes overrepresentation, that's why anti-Semitism is part of it, or underrepresentation, which is blacks, that is all due to racism, right? The corruption of our society. There can be no other explanation. And a corollary of that is that Blacks, people who are victims, who are oppressed, the ones who are underrepresented, right, in some way or another, they can do no wrong. They can in no way be responsible or blamed for any of this. It has nothing to do with their actions, their conduct, their choices. That is just verboten. Of course, that's Ibram Kendi's fundamental point. And Ibram Kendi, who is on many levels very simple-minded, at least he comes right out and says it in plain English. I will give him that. Okay. But it is so obvious and the data is so glaring that this is just not true. This is not the source of these disparities. The source of these disparities lies elsewhere in the achievement gap, in the IQ gap, or whatever its source, in all sorts of malfunctions and dysfunctions in the Black community, their extremely high crime rate, the weakness and delicacy of their families, that they have an extremely high out-of-wedlock birth rate, and peddle to us the lie that single-parent families as a whole do as good a job as two-parent families. And of course, the additional lie that all of these single Black men kind of bouncing around is good for their community or their society. It's really an ecological disaster, frankly. But none of this can be said. Now, whites can be denigrated, attacked, openly despised, and everything associated with them, all the good stuff even, can be run down with no consequences. I mean, I've seen that over and over again. What is interesting and weird, and you've alluded to this, is that whites go along with it. They don't even take their own side in a fight.
Yeah. They're Robert Frost liberal. They refuse to take their own side in an argument.
They refuse to take their own side in an argument. And it's going to have, it is already having corrosive effects on our society. Let me say a word about anti-Semitism, which is a term I don't really like because it's just one of these vague terms that gets thrown around without much precision. And that's a problem for me. I'm not saying there is no such thing, but I think it's actually rarer than people say. The reason that, you know, Jews are part of the kind of mass of white people who are despised, and they are technically whites, Caucasians, is because they punch above their weight, right? Jews are 2% of the population, and yet they are many times that percent of Nobel Prize winners, scientists, successful people in all spheres and realms. And the woke attitude is, if there's a deviation from parity and Jews have all sorts of very powerful and important and lucrative positions, well, that must be because of some kind of malign influence, right? They are malefactors by definition. This can't be legitimate. It has to be suspect, nefarious. So this is, you know, I mean, the Nazis actually thought that way too. I'm not saying that woke people are Nazis. I'm just saying they share this kind of attitude towards Jewish overachievement. And Jewish overachievement is real. Absolutely, it's real. I mean, I myself am 100% Ashkenazi Jewish, so maybe I'm just touting my own group, but I think objectively, that is the case. And God bless America. America is a place where people can go as far or as unfar as their efforts will take them. And that's a good thing. Now, it might introduce down the road some problems, which, you know, we can get into if you want, if there is so much, too much lopsided influence of one group. And we have to ask, you know, what elements of the culture are they preserving? What elements of the culture are they attacking? I mean, right now, frankly, whites are the problem. My children and their young friends say, really, it's white people that are leading the charge against white culture and white society. And they're, I mean, it's true. They're doing so in the name of the oppressed and victimized minorities. They think they're doing them a favor. Of course, they're not. But, you know, this is pretty much the situation we're faced with.
I remember in the, I was in college from 1990 to 94, and there was an article in Commentary shortly before then that was dealing with what at that time was, I think, a fairly new movement, which was to, quote, diversify the faculty. And so on our campus, I was at Harvard, on our campus, there was a very outspoken group of students demanding a more, quote, diverse faculty. And of course, you know what that means. They'll all have exactly the same ideas. They'll just look a little bit different. Right? That's the that's what these people are marching for.
I call it tribal diversity. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So that's what they want. And the thing was that college, the university was too cowardly to say what was just staring them in the face in this Commentary article, which was, at Harvard University, we hire people with terminal degrees. That's the policy, okay? You have to have a PhD. And if you're going to teach in our math department and you don't have a PhD, then your aspirations are not in line with our demands. And so, okay, how many black PhDs are there in math that are being churned out every year? Sometimes it's zero, sometimes it's two. I mean, it's not 200, it's not 2,000, it's two. Or, you know, in European languages, sometimes it's zero. And you go down the list and it's a handful or zero. In American history, including African-American history, I think it was about maybe half a dozen in a given year, according to Commentary. So therefore, it's mathematically impossible to meet these people's demands. It cannot be done. So right. Then, of course, the next stage is to say that the credentialing is racist, and then you can go down that.
Well, of course. I mean, that, but at least I agree with you. There has been a failure of leadership on a catastrophic level, right? Because back in the maybe the 80s and the 90s, when this diversity idea was accelerating and spreading everywhere in academia, there was a chance, a little window for the leadership to say, no, we, on our standards, which we believe in, see, they'd have to say, we believe in our meritocratic standards. We think, you know, they're not perfect, but they're good, and we're going to keep them. On those standards, we're not ready to diversify in the way that you're demanding because the numbers are out of whack. Now, that was not even said.
No.
Nobody in the core establishment was saying that, right? So that was a failure on an important level. Now, you're right that they would come back with the stock answers, which is, well, your standards are defective, they're arbitrary, they're socially constructed, they're white, they're patriarchal. I mean, every insult you could think of to attack those standards, and then you'd have to formulate an answer to that, and that's hard work, right? And the second is, well, if blacks are not up to speed, and we don't have any black math PhDs who would be appointed by Harvard or anybody in any field where there's paucity of blacks, that's your fault. And you have to fix that. You have to make that happen. But that's an instance of leading a horse to water and not knowing how to make them drink. I mean, how do you get people to sign up for a PhD program in chemical engineering? Or how do you get people to sign up, you know, for a PhD in math? I mean, PhD in math is hard. You have to be super, super smart and determined. And you have to be interested. It's not even just a matter of the mental equipment, right? It's a matter of orientation. And the myth is out there that in a truly fair, non-racist society, every group would be proportionally represented in every field. Well, sorry, that is fairy tales. It is fairy tales that have not now become part of the standard core set of beliefs that everybody has to have.
But I can say anecdotally, at least, that behind closed doors, even some of these folks kind of understand. Like, for example, he's deceased now, but Alan Brinkley was the provost of Columbia University for a while. His
Alan
father
Brinkley,
was the
I
news-
know him. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, he was my PhD dissertation advisor.
Oh, huh. He's a nice guy.
Yeah, he was a nice guy. I mean, even though we disagreed, he was super professional. I mean, I ended up producing, with his guidance, my dissertation got published as a book by Columbia University Press, and I owe him a debt of gratitude for that. But I remember asking him, as I was, because in those days, I thought I would have a long career in academia. And now, I mean, I work on my own now, and I'm much more successful. I'm much happier. I don't have to answer anybody. I prefer, that's why I can make these cavalier remarks about the word racism doesn't matter anyway. Yeah, it's easy for me to say. But anyway, Alan Brinkley, Alan Brinkley said to me when I was saying, you know, I'm concerned if I go on the job market. I mean, let me be blunt with you. I don't have the characteristics I think they're looking for, if you know what I mean. And he said, well, Tom, I can tell you, having served on many search committees, that your concern should not be that there are minority candidates who are likely to outperform me, because almost none of them are ever qualified, he said to me. Flat out, almost none of them are ever qualified.
Yeah.
And then when I was in the graduate program at Columbia.
Well, that was a long time ago.
Now it was, and I'm sure, yeah, Alan Brinkley would be considered hopelessly right-wing today. But I will say, in the program, we had, I don't know, probably four, it was a small group, but four students who were belonged to one minority group or another. And I don't think any of them finished the program, but they all got full funding, which was therefore taken away from people who might have finished the program. And in the classroom, when we were still doing coursework and seminars, it was so obvious how unprepared they were for this level of work that even all these leftists I was in class with were grumbling about it, because some of them hadn't gotten the funding. And so they were in the whole $25K a year in graduate school. So on some level, they all get it. And yet, either they don't dare say it, or they feel like they'll be a bad person if they say it. That's the thing with the left. I don't want to be a bad person. And so they sabotage themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I see it because, well, first of all, let me say that since then, the 90s, of course, there's been a much more concerted attack on the very idea of merit. Double standards are much more pervasive. Tests have been dumbed down or eliminated. I mean, all of these things are happening. The cycle is not yet complete, but it's absolutely happening. But in terms of people having their doubts about the catechism of the cathedral here, they exist, absolutely. But we now have this gap between what's said in public and what's said in private, which in itself is pernicious and the hallmark of a tyrannical, despotic society, which we ought to tolerate. Now, I'm not saying you should speak your mind in every setting. Right? You're not going to get into race realism at someone's birthday party or whatever. That's just kind of basic social skills. But in any kind of academic setting or policy discussion, this stuff should be aired, right? So there is this situation. Now, I hear from students regularly, and not just students, but, you know, grad students, postdocs, academics even, from all across the country. I mean, the internet is a wondrous thing. People email me. We support you. You're right about so many things. Thank you for hanging in there. There are people out there, many of whom are quite intelligent and educated, who write me, who ask to meet me. I have a whole kind of cottage industry going of meeting these people for coffee or lunch or a drink or whatever. And there is, you know, on Substack and in people's various blogs, you know this, right? A huge community of people who are discussing these issues and really having discussions. They don't always agree, and that's great. So I just, before this interview, looked at Richard Hanania's recent post, right, in which he says, and I'm not sure I totally agree with him, that our technocratic society and the demands on private companies to compete and deliver services are going to blunt the actual effects of DEI initiatives. So he focuses on the airline industry. This is something that came up when he interviewed me for my podcast, and Steve Saylor has written about it. A number of people have written about the data that someone managed to get about DEI programs for air traffic controllers. Now, that's scary, the notion that they're going to have affirmative action for air traffic controllers. I mean, the joke is, talk about DIE, people will die. That's going to stand for die, all right, if we do that. But Hanania says, well, maybe air traffic controllers because they're government employees, but pilots, people who work for airlines, they aren't going to make a big show of trying to diversify their pilot cadre, their workforce. But at the end of the day, they are going to wash out people who can't perform because they don't want their customers to die. They have promised safety to their customers. Now, I think the airline industry is maybe the one place where there's something to that. I do not think it's true for academia. I think the quality, the intellectual quality of people in academia has plummeted under the influence of DEI. I think in journalism, we're seeing an incredible dumbing down. There's in various companies of the level of competence. I mean, if you've ever worked with service people, you know that things are not what they used to be. How far this is going to go, the effects it's going to have, I don't know because I don't have a crystal ball. And when I go around and talk to various student groups and citizen groups, I always get the question, do you think this is going to have a significant effect on competence, on the way that our society runs? And when I do think it will, but I think that it's going to take a while for that to happen. I already see it happening in some ways, and that prospect is scary. It's not just hiring minorities who are, you know, would not otherwise be hired based on competence, because there is a fair amount of that going on, quite frankly. But it's just the assault on, the attack on the whole notion of standards, of holding people to standards, you know, of disciplining them, of firing them, of criticizing them. I have a friend in medical academia who said, if you have a terrible secretary or a terrible assistant or, you know, someone who's working in the clinic and they are not doing their job, it's impossible to complain about them. You're accused of punching down. They treat these jobs like they're some kind of welfare program rather than a position where you are charged with doing a job and doing it well. And if you don't, you're out. That whole attitude, I think, is suffering an erosion. I mean, maybe you have an opinion about this, about how much erosion it's really suffering. I mean, Hanania in his latest post, which is interesting, worth reading, says, you know, a lot of this is just window dressing. I mean, for example, Silicon, any really technical entity or field can't afford to hire people who don't know what they're doing. So they make a big show of their commitment to diversity, blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, it's a bunch of white and Asian guys who are running the place.
And on some level, the powers that be kind of get that that's the way it just has to be. And you don't really see the Justice Department going after these particular places. And now I may be cynical, but I seem to recall years ago, I have a friend whose father runs a big company. And once a year, he would get approached by, what was Jesse Jackson's group? The Rainbow Coalition? I forget what it was called. Rainbow had a different meaning in those days, I guess. But
the premier race grifter, Jesse
right.
Jackson.
but they would get contacted about, well, how much would you like to donate this year to our big whatever it is? And everybody understood this was a bribe to keep them away. You know, we'll leave your company alone if you just make a big donation. I mean, and everybody knew what was going on. You know, it was like in the old Soviet Union. We all know that some of you are on the take and that we're going along with it because if we bribe you a little, we can eke out a livable existence.
Right.
So there's,
you know what Jews call that? They used to in the old days. Nowadays, you couldn't ever say this. They call it the Schwarze tax. Schwarze means black people, minorities. It's the tax that you have to pay to keep the social peace and keep these grifters at bay. Yes, but it's a form of Donegold, really. The additional costs on your organization.
Hey, everybody, quick message from Old Woods here. If you're watching me on video, look what I have in my hand. See? Look. See this? This is my 16-page print newsletter, the Tom Woods Elite Letter, that I mail in the physical mail to people who support the Tom Woods Show. That's one of the 800 zillion benefits you get as a supporter of the Tom Woods Show. And it's 100 octane woods. Now, don't write to me and say, well, that's actually not the correct usage of octane. Shut up. You know what I mean. It's full of hot, great, fantastic content. All original, nothing like my amazing email list. All fresh, new stuff that you've never read before. Coming in the mail to you every single month. Isn't it nice every once in a while to read something not on a godforsaken screen? And is there any other content creator out there sending you a physical newsletter in the mail? I think the question, more or less,
answers itself. But as a member of the Tom Woods Supporting Listeners program, you also get invites to my Christmas party every year and also to my murder mystery dinner parties that I hold all over the United States. Everybody else has to pay hundreds of dollars to attend those, but not you, smart supporter. You get in for free. Not to mention you get to join the Tom Woods Show Elite, where you can talk in my no censorship group to other normal people. Plus, you get transcripts of all the interviews I do and so many other goodies, you're going to feel like a kid in a candy store. So how do you get all these goodies, including, look at this thing. Look at this thing. Look, 16 pages. Look at this thing, all right? You get that every single month in your mailbox. How do you get all this stuff? Supportinglisteners.com. You've been thinking, maybe I should do that, right? Today's the day. I am the voice of that angel, the good, you know, the good one that's telling you to do good things. That's me right now. So head over to supportinglisteners.com. Be a part of the greatest community in the world. Get more goodies than anybody's given you in the world, as well as my profound thanks. I feel like I would be remiss not to ask you before we finish a little something having to do with law school. If I ever were to have you as a guest again, I might ask you about your particular ordeal at Penn, but I feel like you're probably tired of talking about that. So what I'd like to ask you is...
Well, I would talk about it in detail once Penn resolves my case. They've been hanging this over me for months and months now, but I can talk about some of the details, but I can't really give the full story. And when it's finally over, whatever happens, I am all in to talk about it in detail. They say it should be confidential. That's total bullshit, okay? I am certainly not going to keep this confidential because the confidentiality is to protect them and to protect them from having to explain themselves and justify themselves. But anyway, I can answer a few questions if you like.
Well, it's just as well, though, because I do have a different question that I'd like to ask you relating to law schools. But before I ask that, are you considering writing this up? I mean, maybe even a book when it's all said and done?
Well, when it is all over, and I certainly am going to write about it. Whether I'll write a book, I don't know. I am got a pet peeve these days, which is people, because, you know, you can post any damn thing on the internet and just put it up there. There's very little editing. There's very little blue pencil. I think people go on and on and on in a way that they probably shouldn't. So I like things short and sweet. I might start a Substack. Some people have encouraged me to do that and start writing about here's how it happened, here's the blow by blow, and this is why the universities are, you know, a joke right now, frankly, in terms of basic intellectual values of consistency, coherence, principle, rigor, any sort of valid, defensible approach to these issues is just doesn't exist right now. And so, yes, I will at some point write it up.
Well, what I'd like to ask is, since you've been in the law school system for some time and not uninterrupted from when you were a student, but you've been in the law school for quite some time.
Now I practiced law for 7 years, so I've been a lawyer all along.
Right. So my question is about not the current state of things, but rather about trends that you've observed. So that could be the caliber of the students over time, intolerance of dissent over time, or even something like, as I recall, in the 1980s, the fashionable school of thought in the law schools was critical legal studies. And I think that's just kind of fallen away. I don't know how that happened or what replaced it, if anything.
Well, I think that critical legal studies has not so much disappeared as it has morphed, right?
Okay.
Into this woke catechism, this sort of all-encompassing paradigm that the world is divided into oppressor and oppressed, and the, you know, oppressed have special privileges. Those privileges have to be honored. They're fragile, vulnerable people. Their psychological state is an ever-present preoccupation. I mean, everything that goes with the way that education is done these days has been imported into the law schools. I think the biggest change, the most significant and the most destructive change I've seen in law schools, and there are a number, is not the quality of the students in terms of their intellectual caliber. I mean, we do have affirmative action, and that does require double standards. It's not a thumb on the scale. That's a myth. It's big gaps in qualifying numbers and the corresponding ability levels, but most of the students really have very high scores, good grades, and there's great inflation, but their LSAT, I mean, our average LSAT at Penn Law is close to the top 1% of LSATs. I really have to appreciate how exclusive the top 10 law schools are in terms of the ability level they demand of your ordinary average student. But the students may be IQ smart, but they are completely miseducated. I mean, they don't know anything because they've been through K through 12 and four expensive years of college, and they've only learned what the progressive left allows them to learn. Okay. An example I give is students, they study inequality and disparities and race up the wazoo if they major in sociology or social science or psychology, and many of them do, especially the females, right? They come out of that experience with huge gaps in their basic historical knowledge. If you ask them about the Moynihan Report in the mid-1960s, in which Moynihan was very concerned about the ominous trend in family, Black family breakdown, and how he thought that that was going to have very detrimental consequences in the future, which it has had. He was roundly attacked for that report, but I can't imagine studying race in America without knowing about that. But they don't know about it. They don't even know who Moynihan is. I mean, literally, they were born yesterday. So there's
But they could just guess that it was racist. They'd be right.
Yeah, it was racist. That's all I need to know. Yeah. They don't need to know anything else. It's efficient. But the other thing that I think is going on in law schools, which is very bad for the profession and very bad for law as we practice it here in the US of A, out of the Anglo-British tradition, is the refusal to even hear arguments on both sides of the question if it's a hot button issue, right? It just absolutely, you cannot even say things that might constitute a counter argument. So let's take the affirmative action case, right? To launch the arguments against affirmative action, you have to bring forward some unpleasant facts. You have to say things that are not in keeping with the progressive woke ideology. You have to do a lot. You have to make real counter arguments to really understand what happened in the affirmative action case. And the students aren't learning to make those counter arguments. They are not learning to take up both sides of the question to the best of their ability. And that makes them very lazy and very ill-equipped to go out into the real world and practice law, because in the real world for now, and who knows whether it will change, saying what justly can be said for both sides is a key part of being a good lawyer. So, you know, many students, not all, because some of them are just natively understand this and are not intimidated by the zeitgeist, they understanding that you need to be able to argue both sides. But if you can't even talk about one side, how can you do that? So what I have noticed at Penn Law, for example, is that in the wake of the affirmative action decision, the Harvard case that came out last term, there have been really no academic panels or discussions or presentations that look at the actual decisions and opinions, you know, and there's 257 pages of them, including, of course, John Roberts, Chief Justice's main opinion, which decided the case and all the arguments that he made. There has been no kind of formal legal dissection of this decision. I haven't seen any presentation on that. I know the Federalist Society, the Student Federalist Society, in a few weeks is going to have one of the lawyers who was on the plaintiff's side come and talk, right? But that's fine. But what we really need ideally is a panel where people dissect these opinions and, you know, teach the students what arguments were made, what arguments prevailed, what facts were presented, all of that. I haven't seen it. And I think it's because the Black law students, who actually have a kind of tyrannical control over the place in a way that the officials acquiesce in, they don't want that. They don't want to have to hear the actual arguments that prevailed. They consider that traumatizing and mentally harmful. And they have a whole vocabulary of mental trauma. They routinely trot out to prevent the expression of what they consider to be unacceptable ideas. And of course, the ambit of the acceptable ideas is so ridiculously narrow that they can't even really fully discuss a recent Supreme Court decision.
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, of course, the outstanding example of that is what happened. Now, I'm sorry, I can't remember his name, but the federal judge who spoke at Stanford not that long ago.
Yeah.
He couldn't even give his talk.
Kyle, I'm blanking on his name.
Kyle, I knew.
Exactly,
I can't,
who you mean.
Yeah. But yes. Then I read some lawyer suggesting that the students who disrupted that presentation, that there ought to be some kind of penalty for them in some way, professional penalty.
Well, I 100% agree, but you're not going to get it out of the people who run law schools and universities. They are spineless. They will not discipline. Well, first of all, for them, minority students can do no wrong. They can never not only not be disciplined, they cannot even be admonished or criticized. Now, at the end of the day at Stanford, the dean did step up and say, you know, you can't disrupt speakers, you can't disrupt classes. I don't know how seriously this will be taken in the future, but did not impose any penalty. I think things would change very rapidly if students that disrupted speakers in classes were suspended. That's real and palpable. But there would be a hue and cry about that a lot of university administrators couldn't deal with. These people are. They're mediocrities. I know that's a broad generalization, but that has been my, I've dealt with Penn administration the past 2 years in my case. I can't even tell you some of the absurd things that have been going on. And I have not been impressed by the people in the Penn administration.
That sounds like a great understatement with which to end our conversation. I have not been impressed.
I've not been impressed.
Sums up the way I look at the whole world right now. So it looks to me, because I always end by giving people an opportunity to get to know the guest better by linking to a website or to social media. And I don't know that you have those things. Do you have any articles that you think are particularly interesting I should link to?
I do not. I'm quite a Luddite and very old-fashioned. I don't have a huge online presence. But if you Google me, and, you know, words like race or affirmative action, there will be pieces I've written for Law and Liberty, for Chicago Law Review Online, for the American Conservative, for Claremont Review. I have been appearing in these outlets the past year or so, not much, because I'm working on my case, which is a full-time job. I mean, I've written hundreds of pages of briefs for the case against me at Penn, or I've been working in collaboration with my lawyer. But I still have been publishing stuff. I just published a review of Richard Hanania's book in the American Conservative, which has been getting a lot of discussion. My review is getting a lot of discussion because I talk about how race realism needs to be brought back to defeat woke. And that's something that, you know, not a lot of people are saying.
Well, I had him on to talk about that book. I thought that was a very interesting book with a thesis I hadn't thought of.
Yeah, and I praise the book, but at the end of the day, I think his thesis is unpersuasive. You know, I admire Richard Hanania, and we are on very good terms and the like. And to his credit, he invited me on his podcast to discuss it. He's very open-minded and fair, I think, which is a rarity these days.
Yeah.
But yeah, all this stuff will pop up, and a lot of my presentations will pop up. I just gave one for FIRE. That should be on YouTube. I just gave one out in Vancouver. My latest topic is, what does a conservative education look like? And I am going to be speaking on that in a number of venues in the next few weeks, a couple of private clubs, but also I will be speaking, well, I forget what all the gigs are, but, and that I think is a really important topic. And I will be writing a topic up at some point. So, you know, I am out there. I'm not on Twitter, because I just think Twitter will get me in trouble. And I just don't believe you can say anything all that coherent in the little amount allotted to you on Twitter. I should have a Substack. And I think when I sort things out with Penn, I will seriously consider starting a Substack. That's where I can post things. Because frankly, one of the things that happens to people like me, dissenters, cuckoos in the nest, were shut out by all the conventional publications. I mean, I doubt a law review, a student-run law review in any part of the country would ever publish anything by me. I mean, I'm just radioactive. I can get published in the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy, which is the FedSoc journal. I could get published in Law and Liberty. These are online right-leaning outlets, tablet. Of course, Claremont. I've written for Claremont quite a bit, and they and I have a good, very good close relationship. But yeah, you're shut out of the conventional printed outlets. But anyway, those are getting more and more passe. So I will certainly think about it. Because I'm not on Twitter, it's a lot harder to attack me. That doesn't mean it doesn't happen. I mean, I get hate mail. I hate the word hate because that's another muzzy term.
Yeah, right.
But a lot of negative, hostile mail. What's so interesting is these champions of wokeness and the downtrodden and oppressed, they have no compunction about calling me names related to my Jewish background and my age. You know, oh, the amount of ageism, the misogynistic ageism out there is amazing. You old hag, you witch, I hope you die, you wrinkled old lady or whatever. I get a lot of that. And then you type, there's a lot of resentment towards Jews. I don't take it all that seriously, but it's definitely out there. And I hate to say it, but, you know, now that we have the very significant contingent of people of Arab descent or Muslim descent, and especially recent immigrants, with few exceptions, these people are all very hostile to Jews and to Israel. There are exceptions like Rehan Salam at the Manhattan Institute, who's Muslim, who says, we stand with Israel at the Manhattan Institute. But really, that is not the general pattern. So we are importing anti-Semitism. We're importing anti-gay sentiment. We were importing people from populations who do not share our Enlightenment assumptions, our post-Enlightenment assumptions. And we just refuse to face that. I mean, maybe a lot of these people believe in magic dirt. You know, the minute they hit the United States, they're going to think just like us. And no, that doesn't happen.
Well, I will dig out a few pieces that seem interesting. I'm sure they all are. But I'll link to them. The show notes page is tomwoods.com/2441 because it's episode 2441. So I'll have some of your pieces there. But then people can do their own searches at their own risk.
I did a review of Charles Murray's Facing Reality, which I really am proud of. In Claremont, that was last year, so you might link to that. Some of the recent things that I've done. I've done a number of pieces about affirmative action for Law and Liberty. There's one at University of Chicago Law Review Online that I think is, you know, it's pretty scholarly and lengthy. You can link to that. That's online. I think it's open sourced. So some of those would be of interest to your listeners.
All right. I've just jotted them down. Well, I appreciate you taking an hour out of your morning to be with me today and answer all these questions. So Amy Wax, thanks so much for your time.
And thank you for having me. Goodbye.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.